You're on board KCAA's Inland Talk Express. KCAA, Loma Linda, 1050 AM. The station that leaves no listener behind.
This episode of the House of Mystery is brought to you by Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. LegacyFoodStorage.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is back from his karate challenge.
The challenge?
Well, yeah. It's always a challenge, isn't it?
It's always a challenge.
At your age, it must be a challenge going to anything, right?
Yeah. It's a lot different now than back when I was like 18, yeah.
The recovery time must take longer.
Yes. Oh, yeah, especially after doing a weekend seminar or something like that. It's, yeah, no good to anyone for a few days after that.
yeah, because I would imagine, because I notice things just that aren't as strenuous as what you do, and I would think that, and it takes me longer to recover than it would, 30 years ago. So that's 20 years ago, 10 years ago.
I can still pull a muscle or something, just rolling the wrong way in bed, I'm doing all the strenuous stuff and then.
Yeah.
Well. Buy your shoes wrong and.
Yeah. Geriatrics. Yeah. You'll be in that ward pretty soon, right? And another death yesterday. You see that?
Which one?
Oh, Crosby.
Oh, I did see that.
Yeah, 81. I thought he was older. And, for some reason, I thought he was older than 81. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But that is quite an age. But he did He did pretty good, 81.
Yeah.
Rocker lifestyle. Bad. Yeah, rocker lifestyle with all that,
Yeah, for being a rocker, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't believe, and what's her, she's 85, Jane Fonda.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. And she's doing that workout video now.
Oh, is she?
We're talking about all those reboots from the 80s, like Night Court and all that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, now she's doing the reboot. Remember she did those videos in the 80s?
Yes.
With all the pastel colors. And well, she's redoing it at 85.
Wow.
Yeah. That's that's what I'm going to get you for your birthday.
Perfect. I'm going to put on some leg warmers and...
You can be like Flash Dance 80s style all over again, and I can see it. And you could be working out at home, and your wife will come home, and then she'll turn around and say, I'm going back to work.
That's right. Yeah. She does that anyway. So.
It's just, I'm doing a double shift tonight.
Yes. Yeah. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah. See you in those Flash Dance tights. Anyway. Well, let's get on with this. Now, so we've got an author today, and I guess a Canadian author. I didn't know this, but her new book's called The Extra, and it's a Monument Studios mystery, and that's the Monument Studios Mystery Book 1, and that's all the name is. It's just a short name. And the author's our guest, Mel Anastasia. Thank you for being here.
Hi, it's lovely to be here, Alan, and hi, Dave. Oh my goodness, yes, I'm so sorry to hear about Crosby. I love the portrait of him that Bob Dylan did in Chronicles. It was just amazing, greater than life figure. Yeah, that's what I like to write about, ordinary people with greater than life figures.
It's fun. Yeah. But you haven't written about me yet.
I'll have to start. And Dave, you'll be doing karate in any book I write with you.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you can watch his demos live on all the different social media.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It's good to have these extra skills. Do you write, Dave?
I do, too. Yes. Multi-talented, right?
No kidding. Do you find that you use your karate in your writing?
I do.
Oh, fantastic.
I do. I always have a character who has to fight.
Awesome. Makes a difference. My editor is an expert in mounted combat. So anytime there's a horse in anything, I send it straight to her.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing like experience when you're trying to write something or you write characters. When you have a person that does that or is involved in that, it makes a world of difference, I think, than trying to do it from scratch.
Mm-hmm. And getting it right, because you know there's going to be a karate expert or a mounted combat fighter out there.
Yeah, well, it's true, you know, and that's why, you know, you got to be careful. You can mention guns, and if you don't know enough about them, you could mention the wrong gun or make or something about it. And, of course, there's going to be that person out there, especially in the U.S., that knows every detail about the gun, and they're going to write about it, about how wrong you were.
Yeah.
You know, so it's important.
That's right. You don't want to make those guys angry.
No, because they'll show you how the gun works. and it might not be good. So, yeah.
Mystery writers, we always think that way, don't we?
Yeah, most of the time.
Yeah.
Just a few days. So what is this story all about here? What kind of book is The Extra? And it looks like you're doing a series with this. So what's kind of the foundation or the basic premise of this story?
Well, you're right, Alan. It's a series. I love to write series because you've got to develop those characters. And Frankie Ray is a good one for me, because she's a substitute school teacher in Vancouver in 1934 with a very beautiful best friend. And the two of them go to an audition for a film that turns out to be extremely dodgy, end up with a gun and heading south of Hollywood to make their names as stars. But instead of that, they end up with a dead body on their couch. And the mystery goes from there. All mixed up with Hollywood in the 30s and the gritty times and the ambition and troubles there, but fun as well.
What do you think draws you to that time period and Hollywood itself? Like what puts you there to where you want to write a series?
Well, you know, Alan, like, think back to when you're a teenager and you're doing something that everybody says is a true waste of time. For me, it was looking at old movies and reading everything that there was to have about old movies and what possible use could that be. And then all of a sudden I thought, I now have all the equipment I need to run off to 1934 Hollywood and become a movie star, or try to. And so that's what my character wanted to do. And since nobody has yet invented time travel, I'd have to do it through my writing and take you with me.
Well, you know, but you never know. Maybe someone has, and we just didn't know it. We don't realize that we keep on reliving things.
That's right.
You have no idea. You've written this book several times, and you didn't know it.
Yeah. And I was really lucky with it, because I had all this. In fact, I had too much information about the movies, because you don't want to put too many details in your book, right? It just ends up reading like a movie history. And so I really enjoyed using all that in what I was doing, and then developing new heroes that are sort of icons of the time, or like icons of the time, like the kinds of crimes that went on at the time, and the tricks and the ways of fame and notoriety and ambition on the sets down there in 1934.
Well, and you're not old enough to have lived it, so you must do a lot of research. What, do you go back to the old papers and sort of see how people, what kind of crimes they committed?
Oh, I've got lots of books on those. And I used to read every, you know what was really useful was Life magazine. I read every Life magazine when I was in university from when it started in about 36 up to about 1950. And that really helped because you get a feel for what worried people, you know, and, you know, sweaty armpits,
yeah,
things like that. And also I was very lucky because my mother just remembers 1934 as a tiny child. And the late 30s. So she knew what was being eaten back then, like the Newtown apples and the Eclair cookies. And I had a 102-year-old friend who was born the same year as Frankie Ray and lived in the house. I used her house as the house in Vancouver that Frankie Ray grew up in. And she was able to tell me so much about what was happening for a person of that age in that time.
Is that how you also get your dialogue, or do you take it from the historical record? Do you use movies to help with that, or is it all imagination?
Well, 1934, it's more or less trying to write like the screenwriters wrote in 1934. So it happened one night, for example, with the snappy dialogue and the newspaper writer in her pantsuit, which was just barely acceptable then. Katharine Hepburn had just started doing it, and things like that, that you find the influence of the writers of the time who were writing gossip magazines and the kind of ways that they went at you emotionally. So all those kinds of things were really helpful for writing the way people spoke as much as I could in 1934.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, and just in, you know, finding out about things and what people did and what they like to eat and what their trends were and stuff. So with this story, because you're doing a series, is there some sort of an ending, or do you know how many books you want to do in this series and where you want to take this whole series and your characters?
Well, I always think I'm going to write a trilogy, and then it ends up being more than that. So, because I love the characters, and hopefully Frankie's going to have a very slow climb because she really has not much talent and she doesn't have the looks to make it. But what she has is a can-do attitude. It was a big deal and still is. And, so I'd like to take her as far as I can with all the mysteries. The next one's going to center on a hotel that is full of screenwriters and eccentric actors that is also on Sunset Boulevard.
How are you developing your character here, Frankie? How are you? You're kind of starting in one place, and you're going to put her through things, I guess, with each book throughout the series. Is there an intention? Do you kind of want to turn her into something, do you know, or develop her to, do you have a direction you're going in, I guess is probably what I should say.
Frankie thought she was going to get married and live in Vancouver forever, and then all of a sudden everything happened at once and she had to head south to Hollywood, and even wanted to head south to Hollywood by that point. So her development within Hollywood, in a bigger city with bigger ambitions for herself and for the people around her, because that for Frankie is the deal. In Vancouver, it was her neighborhood. She was going to be one of the Dunbar wives. And when she gets down to Hollywood, it's the group of young wannabe extras and that all live in a setting. It's right next to the Garden of Ella Villas called Paradise Gardens. And they all are trying to help one another to get ahead and make a buck and be an extra and make it on the screen and get some credit. And meanwhile, all the forces further up the line are pressing further up still or further down as everyone's ambitions collide and some step too far forward. And Frankie, in her role as protector, as well as aspiring actor, has to get involved. I like to write about fish out of water, and Frankie certainly is a fish out of water sleuth.
Yeah, and it would be coming from, because Vancouver back in the 30s would have been a really small town. as compared to Hollywood.
There were still marshes all the way, all around the Dunbar area. And yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was smaller than it. But it was also a very difficult time, of course, from the with the depression that's going on, and that's another pressure that's happening all around people's attitudes at the time. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Depresses me.
Well, but the struggles and the helping one another, really, you get that effect. I read Betty McDonald's book, Anybody Can Do Anything, said in Seattle at that time. And just how everybody was trying to get jobs and everybody was trying to help one another. And you'd do anything. And that is like Frankie. She will do anything to help. And if it means waiting on tables or if it means finding a killer, she's ready to do it.
Did she know karate?
I wish she knew karate.
You know, and that's, but you see, it's funny, but I wonder, could a woman actually learn karate in something like Vancouver at that time, you know?
I wonder
if they would allow her to even enter a class of men that were taking some sort of martial arts class. I wonder if 1930 a woman could do that.
I'll have to ask my mom.
Yeah, because you know what I mean, because the way people thought back then was way different, because even in the 60s it would have been kind of unusual, so I could imagine the 30s it just it would be totally unheard of, I would think. You know, so there you go. She has to do it in the underground.
She would. I think you're right on. There would have to be somebody from one of the countries that one of the Asian countries that did it living there that would become her master, but I'm no expert, so.
No, but that's the interesting things about going back in time like that. Things you take for granted now, things we just do without thinking. Back then, you know, I mean, it's almost 100 years ago, but you wouldn't, back then, it wouldn't even be considered. It would be kind of something that you would go, no, you wouldn't even think that way. Or what's a woman doing that for? Because even when I watch the old game shows from the 50s and 60s, they'll even do that. Make jokes of a woman that's decided to be a wrestler or something like this, or a sports reporter, and they all make fun of her. You know, it's almost like, oh, what would a woman do that for? And it's a big deal. Yeah. So I could imagine 1930. But
yeah, oh, for sure. And it's an interesting time because so much of the modern world is still there. It's already there in 1934. Like, if we go back to 1834, you know there's not going to be a hamburger. But hamburgers in 1934, when was the first hamburger? It turns out, according to my research, it was 1925 White Castle, first official hamburger. But I tell you what, 1934, it's got so many opportunities to go down rabbit holes and get absolutely nothing written any particular day.
Yeah, yeah. And that's probably the hardest part of the job, in a sense. But it's something that you need to do, otherwise it'll be missing parts, you know, you miss parts if you don't do that.
Yes, and it's an awful lot of fun too. It's a lot of fun to trace it down, being a mystery writer, finding the mystery of, did they have thermoses in 1934?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, you know, did they have a bathroom? Did they have a phone? You know.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't in their house, no, but they would have a central phone that everybody use. You're right. Yeah.
Isn't that, it's crazy. Go down the road and call. Yeah, so that's cool. So your character, Frankie, how do you experience Frankie, or is Frankie you? Do you have kind of a lot of yourself in that character?
I think we pretty much put all ourselves in all our characters, different aspects, even the murderer. Yeah, right. Absolutely. But Frankie, you've got to have something that you enjoy being in the skin of. And a 22-year-old substitute teacher who makes her break and then tries to get a break in show business. That's a lot of fun to live in.
Yeah, know? Well, it can be.
Yeah.
but it's a big challenge too, right? It's something that, to achieve that. What do you have kind of a theme then? Is there something you're trying to get people to think about when they read this book, not just entertainment?
Oh, entertainment. You gotta love, I think you pretty much gotta love the movies. just when you get back into those, most people, if they get a chance to see, for example, if it happened one night, they go, that is crazy. That is so much fun.
Yeah. And now they cast it differently back then too, didn't they? In the 30s, it would have been a different type of, casting for Hollywood, wouldn't it?
It would be. And the fascinating stuff you have to read, for example, David Niven did a lot of extra work. So I was able to, and he talked a lot about what that was like being on the set, getting your name on and how the days went and how a lot of the extras would sneak off and go to the beach and then come back and get their dollar and things like that. And the ones hoping to make their break and then getting chosen out of the group to be a single figure on camera and survive and get noticed and how much of yourself are you going to sell? Very, very fun to think about how to get ahead. And then the hand in the face of ambition colliding with violence and Frankie and her friend Connie getting caught in the middle.
What made you so interested in the movies of that era? Did you want to act? How did that come about?
I might have wanted to be a movie star when I was 13.
Me too.
But, you know, I mean, my favorite actor back then was Leslie Howard and Olivia, and my favorite actress was Olivia de Havilland. You're both from the 30s, and Leslie Howard was gone by 42. And, yeah, I guess, you know, when I say that, it probably Gone with the Wind got me into it as a young person. And then I just went down rabbit holes practicing for adult writing life. Everything interested me.
Sounds like Dave, actually, you know.
Rabbit holes?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So it's interesting. So now, when you create your characters, do you have a hard time writing the killer or the evil people or the people that cause problems in the story? Does that give you a challenge to get into their mind?
I used to in the very beginning, and then somebody handed me a book on writing by Robert Ludlum, who I happened to be reading at the time. And he said in it that your bad guy or gal had to be, your evil character antagonist had to be have as much belief in his own goodness or her own goodness as, the hero did or the heroine. So the antagonist had to believe in himself or herself. And once that was set, I could see how allowing oneself to behave in a certain way because of these reasons that the antagonist feels is a good reason, then I can build a character that, first of all, is fun to write because I can see the fallacies. So it's fun to write that antagonist. And second of all, it's easier to hide the antagonist when they don't believe they're evil.
Yeah, I guess quite often the evil characters, they believe they're right, you know, in what they're doing, even though it's bad, because they really believe in something and they sort of follow through it with all of their heart because they think what they're doing is something right.
And that makes them scarier.
When you're writing these villains or your heroic characters, are you the type of writer that can hear the character in your mind? Do you have an inner monologue? Is that how, and can you hear the prose? Or is there some other way that you create your fiction?
I think through writing. So although I'll cogitate on a particular turning point a lot, when I'm writing, that's where my thoughts come. So I do a lot of self-correcting and I know how I want the scene to go. And then, as you say, you kind of, because you're playing every character yourself, you're starring as every character in your own book movie, you can write the dialogue as you're going to get from here to here and move the plot along nicely with everybody having their own agendas and your plots are pushing the main character into making difficult and sometimes unfortunate choices. Yeah, you feel it coming. Because it's a balance. Don't you find it's a balance between knowing what you're going to write and being happily surprised at the way it came out. So, because you've got to be surprised too, or you get bored with writing, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, or you can always dress up like your characters and act out the role. I mean, that's what I do. I mean, I get all into it.
Love,
you know,
it.
And the time flies.
For sure. I have one friend who writes. I have one friend who writes an entire. Well, she's very good too. She writes her entire book in dialogue before she writes anything else. I couldn't do it, but I need the breaks.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's the trick is finding what works for you as you get it through, right, when you work out these things mm-hmm. and stuff. So do you ever go back to older work that you've done and want to correct it or change it?
Well, I do correct it and change it.
Well, that's an endless battle, but because as you always progress, you can always go back and go, oh, I should have done this. Like, that'll be an endless job.
Well, yeah, it's kind of feeling endless because I had a bunch of books before I started publishing. I had some books back there that I was really glad nobody picked up because once it's out forever, right? So yeah. I took the book and I said, I'm sorry, I love these characters and I know what to do, how to fix the story now. So it's worth taking 3 months and working through it and saving what kept me writing all those years ago and the characters that lived back then, and bringing that forward.
What made you decide to write and to publish, to let people see what you were writing? Was there some thing that happened to you or something that kind of pushed you into doing that, to actually publishing?
Yeah, I'm a founding editor with Pulp Literature. And what had happened was I'd had some success. I was a novelist who was not getting published. And as I say, good thing too, because there were some things lacking from my work that I so know how to do now that I didn't know how to do then that were very important. But I had an agent and I had an editor, and then things went sort of petered out, and then kids and, you know, and then got into an excellent writing group, and we were sitting there and we all liked one another's work, and it was 2013, and it was at a time when you could send things out and all you got back was, you were still sending paper probably. No, I guess I was sending by email by then. But you would really get no response at all, just an automatic response. And we looked at one another, and you read about Hugh Howey and those guys doing self-publishing, and the three of us founding editors looked at one another and said, you know, we have what we need to self-publish, but if we're having this trouble, and we each said, and your book is so good, we all were big admirers of each other's work, then other people must be having this trouble too. So we need to give people a place where they can submit. And we happen to know that it's very difficult to find genre magazines at that time. So we started up anthology magazine of genre called Pulp Literature, and started to publish through that. And all of a sudden, everything had to be ready to be published that week. And the rest has been history. So we've been publishing other people and our own and the anthology, and it's really taken off quite nicely with the opportunity to publish people from Canada and from the States and the UK and Australia. We've got writers in Finland and Norway and Italy, I think.
We interrupt our programming. This is a national emergency. Important details will follow.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to legacyfoodstorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
If you're a fan of stories that make you afraid to turn the lights off at night, then you will love Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From attorney, former Air Force officer, special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and Bram Stoker Award-winning author, Hank Schwabel, Moonless Nocturne is a chilling set of 10 tales that offers an exquisite and impressive showcase of the author's talents that are sure to entertain and intrigue readers who love a good thrill. With an introduction by the iconic F. Paul Wilson, Moonless Nocturne is a gourmet platter of both red meat and rare delicacies, not only for aficionados of horror, mystery, thrillers, and suspense, but any connoisseurs of fantastic fiction. It's inventive and original. This collection has already been optioned for television and film by Lone Tree Entertainment and is certain to appeal to fans of King, Barker, Matheson, and Jackson. It's not the dark that should scare you. It's all the things that lurk there. Order your copy right now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From author Hank Schwabel.
Morning face. You get it when you don't sleep well. This is what happened to Linda.
Morning, guys.
Good morning. Ah, what is that thing?
It's me, Linda.
Oh, my God, it talks! Run!
No, it's me, Linda, from HR.
It looks hungry! Save the children! Save them! Stay back, I've got mace!
Ow, that went in my eyes!
We're moving!
It's called beauty sleep for a reason. And there's never been a better time to get some.
Get 20% off IKEA Sultan mattresses. IKEA, love your home.
Look, we know that boy's gonna ask again, so let's be ready.
Fine, I'll be him. You ready?
Ready.
Mom, could you hook me up with a GoPhone?
You'll run up the bill, son.
Yo, that's whack, Moms. GoPhone is totally different.
What? It'll only cost me an arm?
Chillax. It has unlimited talk and text.
Seriously?
Word.
Okay, we'll get a GoPhone.
Really? Really? That is the bomb.
Do you even know what the bomb means?
Yes. No.
GoPhone, only from AT&T. With unlimited talk to 65 million wireless AT&T customers, and now unlimited text to anyone on any network. AT&T, your world delivered.
The following is an important time-insensitive announcement from Staples. Now, for an unlimited time only, Staples is drastically cutting their everyday prices on hundreds of products your business needs. That's right. The clock is not ticking. What? Crawl or lollygag to Staples, and you will not miss this opportunity. These are everyday price cuts. Take a four-pack of AA Duracell batteries, was $4.79, now just $2.99. But act now, or later, because these Staples everyday price cuts will be around for a really, really long time. Price cuts, like a two-pack of Scotch Magic Tape, previously $4.79, now just $2.99. And Scotch Packaging Tape, now just $2.29 for today, tomorrow, and pretty much every day till the cows come home. But don't hurry. These everyday price cuts are indefinite. To repeat, these prices will last. So stop by your nearest Staples, whenever it's convenient, and take advantage of these normal, continuing everyday price cuts. Thank you.
Computer, execute 12.4p operation.
Optimizing algorithm. Running encryption packet alpha 99. Oh, I don't feel so good.
What? What is it, computer?
Is it hot in here? It feels hot in here. I feel a little clammy. I should lie down or something.
A computer with a virus? Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
Those oysters Rockefeller were a mistake.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Now back to the show with Alan Dave.
What kind of people are you publishing? Like, what kind of books do you publish?
In novels, we publish in the genre. So we publish mystery and historical and speculative. So we published a slipstream novel. I don't know if you know Matt Hughes. He's an amazing science fiction writer. So we published his book, What the Wind Brings, which is a slipstream historical set in South America. And he actually won the Endeavor. It was the last Endeavor he tied, and the first Canadian win with that book. We just love that book. And we published Advent by Michael Kamakana. He's actually Alice Munro's nephew. And he's a coma survivor who is an incredible writer. And he wrote this short literary science fiction novel that we published. I was blown away. I live in England some of the time, and I was on the tube going, oh, okay, here's another one. Holy smoke! This is incredible! This is exactly what I keep a row of books on my, in my office, books I wish I had published. And, I suppose I've got books I wish I'd written, but not really, but books I wish I'd published. And, some of them were, amazing literary science fiction, like Station 11. And, a couple were, one of my favorite ones, if it's done right, which is when they say, we did this, we did that, first person plural. There are very few books that works in, but this one did for part of it. When you need to be hidden or you need to be a part of a huge group. And that was amazing. Yeah. So, it's been quite an adventure. We've got a fantasy novel coming up from Brenda Carr. And, Jen Landell's, trilogy of Corral and Aria. And the third one is just out there, which is Corral, with beautiful high fantasy writing. Yeah. Just stupendous. It's so exciting. I love doing I do the structural editing for novels and for short stories. So, because I was saying that, in my youth, I had trouble with structure, was really spoiling the party for me. And so I did so much work. I can't even call it a rabbit hole. It was like a master's class in dissecting movies and reading everything on structure I could find and just outlining every book I read, every movie I saw to see how the structure worked so that, for example, The Extra, would work as a movie, really, or a series, that kind of thing, because I write as a movie is written, not in dialogue, but in structure. Yeah, so much fun.
So you must be a terrible person to watch movies with.
I try to shut up.
Because you just, like, rip apart everything right from the
but
beginning.
But only to admire, Alan.
Well, it's true, but someone watching it's going to be like, oh my God, stop it.
Yes, but only in my head, because I want people to like me.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah. You know, I've never tried that. Maybe I should.
What's that?
Wanting people to like me.
Everybody likes you, I can tell.
No, that's what's been holding me back. I got to start being nicer, I guess. I don't know. Something's going on there, because losing friends, you know. Well, what's your own structure in writing? So, like, are you the type of person that do you schedule time and you can say, okay, you know, 1 to 3 today I can write, and you can sit down and write and turn it on? Or is there something that the atmosphere and the mood has to be right for you?
I think if I had to wait for everything to be right, I'd never do anything. I pretty much write most weekday mornings, and I write in a group often. Often it's only a group of two. And we just write individually and then share what we've got after an hour. And that keeps me making sure that something happens in that hour's worth of work, which is about 1,000 words. So that's really a nice kick in the butt for making things move along nicely as you go, and a time of day, yeah.
Well, how do you organize and keep track of the story itself, the happenings, the characters, especially since you're doing series work? And, you know, how do you handle continuity over a long period of time?
Yeah, that's really good. I expect most people who do series work must keep a Bible like I do. So for my Stella Ryman and the Fairmount Manor Mystery series, I have to remember which resident lives in which of the corridors and where the dining hall's located and the alarmed doors and so on. I've got an 80 plus amateur sleuth in a down at heels care home. You'd be cranky too. And yeah, so she's so much fun to write. Yeah, that's the hardest thing about writing series, you know. Once you start writing, you really love. I love Stella so much. I just finished my third book in the was going to be a trilogy, and it's now going to be carrying on because I can't let her go. And but so you go, well, I want to get Frankie to have her next adventure in Hollywood, but on the other hand, Stella's waiting for book 4, and then I've got a series of a heart picture pub mysteries that I wrote when we're in England about a Canadian expat who is mysteries in time through a pub where he keeps going back and becoming a better man as he solves every mystery. Yeah, and you think, oh, I haven't visited Spencer Stevens since 2017. I'd really like to write him. I wish there were three of me.
Well, maybe. Maybe.
Oh, it would help with housework, too.
Yeah, that's something, you know. But, you know. So the outside world doesn't interfere in your writing?
Oh, I'd better. Otherwise, I'd be really tunnel vision, I think. Yeah, I love working from home. I used to do a 5-hour commute when I was teaching. And so writing from home feels like a really big luxury. And I do try to get out. And my husband's very active, so he kind of kicks my butt to get out too. And I like that. And yeah, it's all very good. I've got it. My mom is next door, the one who was around in 1934, and it's nice to spend time with her, take her out for drives and things. Oh, yeah, the outside world does. As you know, and what you were saying, Dave, about do you plan your time? I think that when you've got so much going on, which everybody does, I think even in COVID we had so much time going on, things going on. I just find for me, I have to know that I'm going to be writing from 10 to 12 every day and hopefully get a chunk to work on in the afternoons as well, because you know those three series are calling.
Yeah. How do you know when your book's done? How do you know when you finish the story, you feel like it's finished?
I guess I've always seen the ending from the beginning, so when I reach it, I know it's there. I love to think of that final scene again. I think it's movies. I've always loved them, whether I'm writing about movies or not. There's something of a movie in everything I do. Picturing the opening scene and the ending scene and the darkest hour in the middle and the uplift and the rhythms of it. Lovely to write.
Have you got this like big, huge staircase and you come down holding one of those long cigarette holders, like you're ready for your close up? And is that how you enter the kitchen every day? Yeah.
I must start that.
I'm ready.
I must start that. I'll put a candy cigarette in. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. You don't need to have a real one. You remember it's acting. So you just, you know, you'd walk down the stairs and you know what? Who dresses like that in the morning like that? I that's quite a gown to be wearing in the morning. Yeah. But, you know, it seems like a lot of work, you know.
Yeah.
But, hey, if you get joy out of it, why not? You know?
Yeah.
So what's next? Like, where are you going to go with this? Are you... you know, you said you look at things in a trilogy, but you know that you end up doing more. So there's going to be more in this series, of course. We don't know exactly how many yet, but where else do you see yourself going or developing?
Well, the various mysteries and murders that actually happened in Hollywood and the unfairness that went on are all so inspiring, and the pressures around the writers and the actors and the directors and the producers who had all the power but were themselves pressured by outside sources. And in 1934, there's big time pressures on all of Hollywood to be extremely godly and well behaved, which was not what they really had in mind. And there's just so many pressures. And I know that F. Scott had, what was his last name? Oh, Berg. Scott Berg wrote a biography of one of the great producers, Goldwyn. And what he did in there helped inform what King Samson does in the first mystery. And then some friends of mine had gone and stayed in the Chateau Marmont that's been there since 1925, and things happening right across the street, really, from the Garden of Allah, where everything was happening. So there's so many settings, and I think that the setting of Hollywood and the settings within Hollywood really make for amazing pressures for mysteries to happen with all these characters. So it's really handling the characters and not getting so many that it gets uninteresting for the reader, and choosing your sparks to make the fire go.
Now, did you get into the the racism and the things that were going on back then too?
Yes, absolutely. And the racism, not being able to act, and well, we've all seen it on the recent ones that have come out on TV. There's so much good streaming stuff on the platforms of it. And of course, in the 20s, there was a wonderfully huge gay community that was just trampled on by the producers, and everybody ran off and got married and stopped doing what they were doing, except there were lots of parties in the hotels and things like that. So it was still going on, but all of a sudden everybody had to go underground, which was really sad. So so my character, Frankie Ray, has landed up there, and he is questioning, but it's just such an underground thing that nobody's really talking about it. But this will come out more and more as we go along. The racism and misogyny. Misogyny and racism are big in the first book. And then when we get to the one set in a hotel, that too will move on to more discussion of how it was for gay people in 1934.
Yeah, because there became like a standard, didn't they have kind of a...
Yeah, Will Hayes. He used to be the Postmaster General, and he was brought in, and I'd always thought of him as a big, wicked guy. And it turned out that he was actually there to try to stop the churches from having such a huge effect on the movies and directing everything that was going to happen in them. So he was there to sort of be a buffer between the outside pressures and Hollywood themselves. But so he made up all these rules that were ridiculous, but that he felt was protecting Hollywood and allowing them to tell good stories without, the mothers of America in 1934 coming down their necks and going, she cannot show disrespect to her mother, things like that, where they'd actually go in and vet everything. So Will Hayes meant himself to be a buffer, but he wish they had a different buffer.
Yeah, well, if it wasn't him, there's someone else, right? I mean, you go right into Hedda Hopper, and I didn't realize what a hag she was.
Oh, my goodness.
I had no idea.
If you'd ever, if it ever came over you that you suddenly wanted to read a Hollywood autobiography, David Niven's is absolutely hilarious, and he and the two, Hedda Hopper and Willa Parsons, the chapter on them is absolutely amazing, and the forces that were put on with the drugs and the booze and the how do you rise to being an extra and betrayals of by agents and of agents and things like that. It just, of course, it's going to happen. A whole bunch of very young people with suddenly a lot to lose in a time of great need and great excess.
Yeah, it's crazy. Learning Hedda Hopper's history, just about. I had no idea. For some reason, I thought she would be a nice lady.
Oh, no.
And it's like, holy cow, she was like, gays or commies, and and she had some, I couldn't, and she was naming people and trying to get, holy cow, I didn't realize she was so vile. Mm. I really didn't realize she was so, I was just surprised.
They were both vile, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, it's not one, it's the other, if... Someone always kind of takes that role, don't they?
And I think playing the two of them, not against one another, just walking a tightrope between the two of them, because you weren't allowed to talk to Luella if Hedda heard about it, she'd sort of talk you down, that kind of thing. And so many tight wires to walk in Hollywood at the time, and I'm sure now too.
Oh, yeah, it's just, I think it just kind of changes, but as the world does, but, you got to fit different things, And I mean, look at, it's crazy, the whole thing, Alec Baldwin's got arrested, eh?
Oh.
I'm sort of in shock sitting there kind of going, well, wow. Yeah. I'm an actor doing a scene, and the stunt person gives you a gun, and you use it, and it kills someone because there's a real bullet in it. I'm responsible?
Yeah.
I'm really confused.
Yeah, and how much of it is Saturday Night Live? Yeah.
Yeah, how much is it? Yeah, of who you are as a person rather than.
Well, because he did all those.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I know. And, you know, but that's kind of that's the hard thing. You know, I just wonder where that's going. I don't.
Yeah. Wow.
I'd really like to know what they consider responsibility on him when it had to go through three or four different people before it got to you.
Yeah, because it seems so crazy. They gave him a gun, told him to, you know, he didn't even fire it. So
and how many actors do that anyway? You're doing it and you get given the gun by the stunt and you shoot like you're supposed to and I'm supposed to check the gun.
I wouldn't have checked the gun.
No, you just I don't know the whole thing. I will now. Crazy. Yeah. Well. yeah. I'll make sure it's loaded.
Well, I remember they must have was it back in the 80s that actor on a time travel TV show who jokingly held a gun that was not a true gun, one of those ones that just goes bang to his head. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And it killed him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, it's just a bit, look, and that wasn't Brandon Lee was shot too with a knife in a movie.
Oh, I don't remember stuff, that happened, but it's shocking.
Well, I've still, from outside looking in, I still do not understand how live ammo gets onto a set in Hollywood when nothing is supposed to be real.
That's right.
The whole thing doesn't seem...
Well, it seems like you'd want to investigate that pretty carefully.
Yeah, I just want to know why. Why is there even live ammo on the set?
Yeah.
For any reason, because you're never really shooting anybody in any of those things. So... It just the whole thing of how it gets in there, it just confuses me. But I'm not in there full time, so maybe there's a reason they do that. I like to know why, but it's curious anyway, the whole thing. We need Dave on the set because he could be the karate man anyway.
Yeah, right.
Take care of anybody that has a gun. He could kick it out of there. Well, I mean, you could snatch the bullets, right? Isn't that what so fast you could just grab it out of the air when they fire
it? Oh, of course, right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've seen that in a movie.
Of course.
Yeah. You know, Carradine, isn't he? Weren't you Kung Fu or something? Yeah.
Yeah, well, he didn't do bullets, though. Those were like, yeah.
No, he snatched the beams from his hand. Yeah.
Before. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah.
Wow. So, listen, okay, Mel. So now, are you big on social media? Do you have a website? How do you like to interact with your fans or readers or people out there?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Mel Anastasia. And I've got a website, melanastasia@wordpress.com. And, of course, pulpliterature.com. And all our books are available on Amazon and all the platforms. For ebooks and print books.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and if you got stories, send them in.
Yeah, we'll have all that up on the website too, so people can find it if they can't remember or they can't spell like me. listen, how was the pandemic for you over work? Like, did it interfere with your work, or did it kind of? Because with some writers and some artistic people, we found it shut them right down. They were unable to do anything, and others were just sort of went crazy and had a great old time.
Yeah, I arrived home just in BC because I live in the UK in Hertfordshire part of the time. And we'd been there for quite some time. I arrived home just before the pandemic. But because of living there and because we have editors in Toronto and so on, we were already used to Zoom meetings and actually use Discord and things like that. And so we carried on as usual with our writing and our meetings, but we found that we needed to go bigger on social media. So we have a YouTube, we had a YouTube channel. We had meetings for writers so that people could attend from all around the world, and people could do their readings from all around the world. And that was fascinating to have the TV show out there and to be able to talk to people in Norway, because the personal launch, the lunches in person, no longer could happen in Vancouver. But it meant that those same people could still come and launch their stories for the magazine and talk from wherever they could manage to stay up in the middle of the night. Australia was worse. They had to get up at 3.
But,
yeah. So So, and we continue to work together. So I felt like I didn't get as much done as I would like to, but there was a lot happening, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, but strange things. I live on the water on Bowen Island, and in my whole life I've never seen a gray whale right outside the house, and just all the wildlife that was around was intense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and what did he get stressed out or upset, and does that sort of enter into your writing or not really?
I had to keep calm, and to think, this is so science fiction, you know, this whimper yeah. of going into your house, not with a bang, but a whimper, you know, and you go into your house, and we would go out in a speedboat, and for the first time, everybody was, that I've ever seen, during lockdown, everybody was on their docks at sunset every night. I'd never seen that. Just everybody out there watching the sun go down. It was quite Neville Shoot. Yeah.
Yeah. Watching the sun go down for the last day of the life. It's over.
It really was a while. It really was, yeah.
Blip. Well, that's what I mean. But that darkness, that feeling of science fiction, I was wondering if it gets into your writing and you don't realize it.
It hasn't yet got into my writing. I spent so much time alone in England. Well, I mean, my husband was working, so I was on my own a lot and kind of used to that. And actually, there were more people here because we were sheltering my mom next door and so on. So it was... not as bad for me as it could have been for, as I know it was for a lot of people who weren't able to enjoy the writing time as much, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's what happens. So, well, it's been a pleasure.
It has been such a pleasure to meet you both and talk about writing.
Yeah. So now the book we're talking about is called The Extra. And the guest we've had is the writer of that book, and she's also a publisher. Look her up. It'll all be on our site. Mal Anastasia, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Alan, Dave. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mel.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Southern California's Mindspring. The trifecta of progressive talk in Southern California. The legends you love and the best talk.
KCAA Radio has openings for one-hour talk shows. If you want to host a radio show, now is the time. Make KCAA your flagship station. Our rates are affordable and our services are second to none. We broadcast to a population of 5 million people. Plus, we stream and podcast on all major online audio and video systems. If you've been thinking about broadcasting a weekly radio program on real radio plus the internet, contact our CEO at 281-599-9800. 281-599-9800. You can Skype your show from your home to our Redlands, California studio, where our live producers and engineers are ready to work with you personally. A radio program on KCAA is the perfect work-from-home avocation in these stressful times. Just type kcaaradio.com into your browser to learn more about hosting a show on the best station in the nation, or call our CEO for details, 281-599-9800.
Thinking about buying a home or maybe just refinancing? Let the mortgage voice Jeff Barton guide you.
And I think if people get the expectation going into the process, there's less likely to be freaking out at the end about what's happening.
The Mortgage Voice, Saturday at 3 p.m. and Sundays at noon here on KCAA 1050 AM and 106.5 FM.
This is Judge Herb Dodell, and our show is called For the People. It's available every Monday at 4 o'clock. 4 to 5, and we'll be talking about all kinds of things pertaining to the law and how it really works from the inside as opposed to the outside. So tune in and learn all you need to know about the legal system and how it works.
Express 106. 106.5 FM. KCAA. Southern California's best talk. NBCRadioNews.com.
In his book, From the Trench to the Bench, Judge Herb Dodell demystifies the legal system, including both civil and criminal, the lawyers, the judges, and the process. As a judge, former deputy district attorney, and criminal defense attorney, he knows the legal system. He has the inside information that you need to pick a lawyer, and he's here to give it to you. No matter what you're facing that makes you think you may need a lawyer, Judge Herb will shed valuable light on your situation and reveal your best options and many secrets of how the judicial system actually works. To find out more about how the legal system really works, you can get your copy of Judge Herb Dodell's eye-opening book, From the Trench to the Bench, at Amazon.